Good morning, everyone. We're going to get Senate Judiciary started. You notice we do not have all of our members here. Members have different tasks. We're at that stage of the session. They will be coming in as they can. I do not have one of my counsels. Because of that, the bills that are scheduled for today, that are after the carryovers, will be handled when we get him in here. And so at this point, what we're going to be doing is continuing, as I said last Thursday, the testimony that for those individuals who had signed up to give testimony on the informational issues, as well as the three bills that we had for public hearing. So I'm opening up public hearing continuation on the following bills: House Bill 2787A, House Bill 2792A, and House Bill 2797A. So those are open. At the same time, we're also opening the informational hearing on the gun-related concepts that involved guns being on public school campuses, how felons would potentially be limited in receiving their gun privileges back and restoring those rights, and also the issue in dealing with individuals with mental health issues and their ability to have access to firearms. So those informational hearings are also open. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the list that we had for those who signed on for Thursday that were able to make it back. I'm going to just go through the list. Tricia Smith, Joe Worley, I believe, and Tricia Yates. If you're here, please come forward. Remember, we are on limited time, 2 minutes each. If you have your own testimony that's written, please do not try to read it. I'll cut you off. We have the ability that it being part of the record, all of the members will read it upon us getting it either electronically or in hard copy. So, Tricia, if you'd be so kind to start off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. More than 20,000 public employees working in educational settings throughout the state. I will not take my full 2 minutes, Mr. Chair. I am here merely to tell you that OSEA has had a longstanding policy in support of a ban of firearms and other dangerous weapons in schools and on school property. We believe that if we are to ever have a hope of controlling violent behavior in schools, we need to be able to count on the plans that our schools have in place and the professionals that our schools work with to assure that crises are handled appropriately. We don't believe that additional firearms by people not involved in those planning processes in the schools will help us in any way. And so if you move forward with legislation banning guns in schools, we think that's a good idea. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, sir. It must be Joe.
Yes, thank you. Senator Prezonsky and members of the committee, my name is Joe Worley for the record, and I'm representing Oregon School Boards Association. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on behalf of the association. I've provided you with copies of OSBA's sample policies, which are given to districts as they work through this issue themselves. We have 3 points we encourage the committee to consider as you contemplate current legislation that impacts the possession of guns in our schools. First, we support a school board's ability to retain local control over when and how guns are brought into schools, and feel this authority is critically important for the safety and security of our students and staff. Second, we support legislation that provides exceptions to the basic no guns at schools that allow individual school districts to continue to retain existing local control. Third, we support legislation that upholds the 2009 Oregon Appellate Court's decision in the Medford gun case that upheld a school district's right to require employees to leave their weapons at home even if they had a valid concealed handgun permit. As a former public school administrator and teacher, and in my current role as a participant in multiple national safety-related conferences, I've learned these 3 things. No 2 school communities are the same. No 2 incidents involving weapons in our schools is the same, and the best plans for school safety and security comes from a collaboration between local law enforcement, community leaders, and educators. Thank you, and I stand ready to answer any questions, or OSBA would like to offer our support to the committee as they deliberate these issues.
All right, thank you. And Tricia Yates, I called her name. She's not here, I'm assuming. All right, any questions for the two on the panel? Thank you very much for coming forward. I'm now going to ask Michael Morris and Kevin Finney if you two are here. Not seeing them come forward. John Powell, Sheriff Crabtree.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. With me is Sheriff Crabtree from Yamhill County. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we're not prepared to deal with the issue of schools because our committee has not met since that became an issue before the committee. But here to testify really on House Bill 2787, the bill that would keep confidential the information on the applications of those who apply for concealed handgun licenses. The Sheriff's Association has had a position since this issue became that a statewide issue that this information should be held in confidence. It does contain a lot of personal information that we believe the applicants up to the point of the court decisions felt was confidential. And there's been some press recently where the media has done a good job of looking over the applications of all the counties and found that indeed there is a lot of personal information on those applications. So we would strongly endorse the passage of House Bill 2787. And the other bills, Mr. Chair and members, are indeed legislation that we could live with. If they pass in the future, may seek some clarifying amendments, but could live with House Bill 2792 and 2797.
All right, thank you. Sheriff, or did you have anything you were going to be adding?
Just he was here to answer questions if the committee had any.
All right, thank you. Any questions for either gentleman?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. Mr. Powell, is the concern in the confidentiality, is it about the personal information or is it about, in general, the knowledge that someone has a permit?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, it is really, I think, both. An argument can be made that people having the name and address of all CHL holders, and the argument's been made before this committee, that people who secure that information could use it for the wrong purposes of knowing where that guns are available in a certain home for whatever reason, robbery or others.
Can I ask a follow-up real quickly?
You can. I was going to ask a follow-up with the sheriff.
And has that been an issue, or is it just expected that it could be an issue?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonamici, it hasn't been an issue that I'm aware of because this is relatively new since the court decision in Southern Oregon really started this whole issue. So I don't know of a case where somebody has obtained this information and used it for the wrong purposes.
Thank you.
All right, Sheriff Crabtree, would you like to add anything from your experience in your county that would be reflective to the questions that Senator Bonamici has asked? And if you do, please give us your name for the record.
Jack Crabtree, Sheriff, Yamhill County. The only thing that I would add to that is that I would echo John Powell's remarks, but I would also stress the fact that the application that some of the questions that we do ask on the application are confidential. They do ask questions about drug usage and medical marijuana card. We also, several years ago, we started doing it. We did a questionnaire with our CHL holders that asked whether or not they believe that the information should be confidential, and I guess I'm just here to respond to what I think that the people have spoken clearly to, and that is that overwhelmingly, I think out of maybe about 2,500 surveys, we had one person say that they were okay with this information being released to the public. They also felt that it was that they had these CHLs for their personal protection, and they personally felt that they would be compromised if that information was released out to the public without court order or something legitimate like that.
Can I ask just one follow-up? And how long has it been that the information has been available to the public?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I don't know, I can't recall exactly the timeline. The first bill we ran was 2 years ago, so it was at some point in that time frame.
Senator Bonamici, members of the committee, if I can interrupt, the case came out ordering the sheriff to disclose in 2010. This is just a recent appellate decision, 2010. So they haven't had, I assume, very many opportunities to. Prior to that, most sheriffs were keeping the information confidential, is the testimony we heard.
Thank you.
So the decision was very recent, ordering them to disclose.
All right. Senator Wissett, I just wasn't able to hear what she said. She basically said that the decision from the appellate court came out in 2010, and so it's a very recent decision, and previously most sheriffs were keeping this confidential. All right. Thank you all very much, gentlemen, for coming forward. Kevin Sterak, Rod Harder, if y'all would come up next, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder with the National Rifle Association. I have only one comment on guns in schools. When Superintendent Castile was talking, she said that the proponents were going to say guns in schools have never caused a problem with regard to concealed handgun license holders. I would say amen. She's absolutely right. That's exactly what I'm going to say. The superintendent from Portland, when asked, had there ever been a problem by Senator Whitsitt, said no but. We have to have a little more evidence that there are a problem before I would get involved with that one. With regard to the other three bills, Senate Bill 347 recently passed the Senate and is up for hearing in the House, and I'm going to testify in favor of that bill. That bill addresses release of information from any people who have been affected by sexual violence or domestic violence, recently made that information privileged and not released to the public. The irony in all of that is that those same people could apply for a handgun license, and that information would become public record. So there's really something wrong with that picture. With regard to 2792, the comparative training requirements are very different when it comes to concealed handgun licenses. There is no argument with that. Some are more stringent than Oregon, some are less stringent than Oregon. When we pass this, or if this gets passed, it automatically opens up Oregonians' ability to be recognized by a number of other states. They don't ask about our requirements. They just say, you're going to recognize our licenses, we will recognize yours. There is some information that you were given with regard to that from Ceasefire Oregon. With regards, and there's a website on there called CCW Killers that they reference. And I would encourage all of you to look at that because it's bogus. I did some research on that. 57 of the pages out of those 200 and some odd pages are blank. 55 of them are still pending. 7 were acquitted or charges were dropped. And in a number of those cases, as tragic as it is, a child or someone else gained possession of the individual's firearm and created a homicide with it. It wasn't done by the holder, but they added it to that list. And I would encourage you to look at that list, but be prepared because it's not pretty. But there is half of it wrong. Thousands of residents now carry their concealed handgun licenses in Oregon. Non-residents carry them every year. Anyone with a hunting license that buys an out-of-state license from Oregon is allowed by existing law to carry their firearm while hunting or while en route to to or from hunting or a shooting range. Right now, thousands every year are doing that.
Rob, I need you to...
And with regards to 2797, the housekeeping bill, and in closing, I want to compliment Senator Whitsitt on his very timely, accurate, and astute newsletter from last week talking about how poison pills can kill good bills. Thank you.
For the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. I think you all know where I stand on the three bills, but this is the first time in almost the 20 years that I've been around this building that I've been asked to comment on something that I don't know what it is. The concepts that we're dealing with here haven't been made available to us. I've asked for them. I don't know what I'm testifying on, so it's a lot more challenging than it usually is. But we've already concluded that license holders aren't a problem. But we're being told their rights have to be taken away preemptively because of something they might do, even though we've had guns in schools for about 20 years now. And the fact is that any school child is at far greater risk at being abused by a teacher or other school employee than he is by a CHL holder, because that has never happened. If we can't be trusted in schools, I don't know exactly why you trust us here. On the issue of training, I think it's important that we understand that we've been told that, on the one hand, Oregonians don't get sufficient training to be in a school. On the other hand, we're told that we can't recognize other states' permits because they may not meet the lofty training requirements that we have. So I don't think we can have it both ways. I think the issue is far less about training than it is about judgment. And the police have no monopoly on good judgment. As any of you who've seen the now famous video of the DEA agent shooting himself in the foot in front of a classroom full of children immediately after saying he was the only one qualified to carry a gun. In the history of school shootings, I know of none that have been stopped by police. There have been incidents where students have stopped them, students who are NRA trained. There have been incidents where civilians have stopped them. In Columbine, you'll remember that the police agencies who responded stayed outside and as people were gunned down, because they were afraid of responding because there were other police in the room. I don't think that that's how we really want to behave around our school kids. We have heard over the years with this argument that one incident where a janitor left a gun in a backpack in a school. To put that in perspective, I've given your staff a CD with dozens of stories of police leaving their guns in bathrooms and other places. I think we've been around this block now for about 10 years. Clearly, whatever it is that's being planned here isn't necessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much. The next group I have is Elise Gakier and Penny Otomoto. Were you going to start off?
No, Penny's going to
start. Peggy, 2 minutes.
Okay. Chair Brzezinski and the committee members, thank you very much for having the opportunity to testify. My name is Penny Okamoto. I'm the executive director of Ceasefire Oregon. I have a testimony that's written, so I'm going to try to just be very brief and run through my oral testimony very quickly. As far as secrecy is concerned, information just given was erroneous. Law has always been public. So what that means, what I mean to say here is that it's, the secrecy information has always been made publicly available. So this is 2787. We oppose this bill. So our opposition is based on the Oregon Public Records Law, security needs for Oregonians to know if a particular individual has a concealed weapon, the fact that existing law is already in place to shield personal information for victims of domestic violence, and the fact that harm has not come from keeping these records open, but could come from closing these records. Also, we'd like to note that if these records are no longer open, how are we going to have the ability to audit any of this information to know whether or not who's getting what sheriffs are giving concealed handgun licenses to whom. Ironically, the fear of loss of privacy has needlessly led victims to speak publicly in support of the CHL secrecy laws when the laws already exist. That's ORS 192-4451. As far as people gaining access to this information, this is actually from Washington County Sheriff's Office. This is a public records request. So when someone's trying to get information about someone who has a concealed handgun license, this form needs to be filled out. This form in and of itself is a public information. So what criminal, a stalker, someone's going to have to go through this form to get this information first, even to grant a concealed or to grant permission to that information, that's part of a public record. So we've got people who can either protect themselves by asking that the information be kept private because they've been a victim of domestic violence or sexual abuse, or the criminal actually has to go through this to get that information.
I need you to wrap up, please.
I'm sorry?
I need you to wrap up, please, 2 minutes.
Thank you. All right. And then as far as the Violence Policy Center, the CCCW killers, there have been 3 incidents of shootings in school since 2008 of concealed handgun license killers. And that's just 3 too many. And then we also oppose the we support a ban on firearms at Oregon public schools at all levels, kindergarten through university. Guns have no places in schools. You can read my written testimony. Thank you very much for your
Thank
time.
Thank you. Elise?
Yeah, I just want to add that we also oppose the reciprocity bill.
Elise, I need you to put your full name on the record.
Please. Elise, E-L-I-S-E, Gautier, G-A-U-T-I-E-R, also with Ceasefire Oregon. We also oppose the reciprocity bill. For all the reasons we set forth in our written testimony, it sets lower standards for non-residents than for residents. So people from Washington who don't meet our handgun competence standard will be carrying them here, even though Oregonians who don't meet that standard, and it's defined in our testimony, cannot carry them here. The Violence Policy Center relies on newspaper reports of killings by concealed handgun holders. The first page explains very clearly that the numbers do not include acquittals or shootings deemed in self-defense. The website shows that between 07 and to date, CHL holders have killed at least 11 law enforcement officers and committed at least 17 mass shootings in which a total of 73 people were killed. There's simply no good reason to allow people who are capable of getting a concealed handgun license elsewhere to carry concealed in Oregon. It will just lead to additional shootings in Oregon, which we don't need, and it does not benefit significantly in any way Oregonians. It'll just keep them from getting a license from another state in which they carry a gun, and that's just not a big deal compared to preventing felons, domestic violence abusers, and people with mental health illness from carrying concealed weapons in Oregon.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Ladies, thank you very much for coming forward. I have Michael Adams, Heidi Disrude, I believe, and Carla K. Edwards. Good morning. If whoever wants to start, give us your name, please.
Hey, I guess I'll start. My name is Heidi Disrude, and I'm here representing Bike Pack of Oregon on the motorcycle, readily accessible for motorcycle riders. And I'm here as a citizen for having the CHL information released. I'm a school teacher, 12 years. I'm a veteran, 7 years. I'm a hunter, a motorcycle rider. And we need a legal way to carry weapons while riding our motorcycles, and we also need to be legal while we're out hunting. Say, maybe we ride a quad from our site to another site. So that's all I have to say about 2797. Also, 2787, I'm a CHL holder, and I had to take a safety training course to get that. I also had to be fingerprinted, and I believe that information should remain private or in the hands of those sheriffs. The information should not be released.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Carla?
Yeah. Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Carla K. Edwards. I'm with Cascade Policy Institute as the Rural Policy Analyst, and I'm before you this morning to support all three bills as amended. It is important to note, because I want to get to the concepts, that 2792 is important. Often, citizens in Oregon now have to carry two concealed licenses, both Oregon and Utah, if you travel at all, because Utah has reciprocity with 18 other states, where Oregon is only strictly for Oregon. So this would help simplify our system greatly. In addition, 2787 is incredibly important. I also own a firearms store, and I cannot tell you how many women come into my store and ask about the concealed license and if it is public record. And most comments are, I don't want to be discriminated at my workplace because I simply hold a license to carry a concealed handgun. And that is a concern that has not been brought up, that there can be discrimination at the workplace if these are public record. In addition, this ties into the concept of guns at school, and we believe that if you have a proper concealed carry license, it is important that they're allowed at school. And in fact, this, by removal, making it unilaterally removed that no guns can be carried at school, potentially this could make school premises the place of choice to do ill will on a person who otherwise may have a concealed hand license and use it for protection, but cannot carry it onto the school grounds if they're under threat. This concept should not be amended into any of these three bills before you today. In addition, the concept to address access of firearms to folks suffering from mental illness should not be made quickly nor lightly. This is a reason, there's a reason for necessity for both clinical diagnosis and declaration of judge before a person's constitutional right to bear arms should be removed. There are potentially many, many consequences that must be discussed before we move forward with this. People with mental illness may not reach out for help for fear that their rights may be removed, even though they are not violent, and negating them of needed clinical help. Being wrongly diagnosed without due process, and it adds a stigma and discrimination of persons with mental illness as being violent and a person that should be feared. Both of these concepts need to be much greatly debated with actual verbiage before we move forward. We ask that you support the bills as written before you in this amendment and not to support the concepts before you.
Thank you very much. Questions for either individuals? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I had Burrell, Morrison, and I'll call out Michael Adams' name one more time. Good morning. Give us your name for the record. And
my name is Burrell Morrison. I am a parent volunteer in Portland Public Schools. I do a lot of recruiting parents to try and engage them in schools. I've been on a lot of campuses. I've been to a lot of after hours, during school hours events. And the idea that people would be bringing concealed weapons to schools is very troubling to a lot of parents and parent leaders and teachers at the schools. We don't see that there is a good barrier between daytime school activities and after-school activities. We've had physical outbreaks after basketball games, and the thought of having a concealed weapons in a sports event at a football stadium or in a basketball stadium where there's a lot more intensity in the games and people have been drinking, it's possible that things could happen, and we feel like schools should be a gun-free zone where trained security officers and police officers are the only people that carry guns. If schools ever are in use for emergency shelters, it would allow for a gun-free zone that would prevent any activities that were happening in the Superdome after the flooding. So I've done my own review over the weekend, and most people are very disturbed by the idea that people would have concealed weapons at schools. And so we would like to know where the barrier would be between during school hours, where parent volunteers are supposed to declare that they have a weapon, or how leadership in the schools can actually track what's happening in their schools and where there are guns. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Questions?
thank you very much for coming forward. That concludes the individuals that have signed up and the carryover from last week. With that, I'm closing the public hearings on House Bill 2787A, House Bill 2792A, House Bill 2797A, and on the comments on the informational subjects that have been covered. All right, so we're going to start with our rest of our bills. I'm going to do Judy Stigler, once you come forward. You're 100 miles away, and I want to make sure I get testimony. But she gets to walk up here. And so, Pam, if you could please go ahead and get word to Rep. Tomei and let her know, and Rep. Brewer for their bills, and they can come in, and we'll get their testimony. This is going to be, I got to open it up, on House Bill 2772A. Before we get the other part, Megan Schultz is also supposed to be here, I guess, in the overflow. So, Megan, if you can hear me, please come forward. Your testimony will be taken next. And Council, why don't you go ahead and give us the overview.
Ready, House Bill 2272A comes to you from Representative Kotek, Representative Barker. At all allows a person 18 years or older who is under the Family Abuse Prevention Act protective order when under the age of 18 years to seek a renewal of that order if the person reasonably fears abuse once they get beyond the age of 18.
All right, thank you. Farmer Representative Stigler, would you be so kind to start us off?
I would be most happy to, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and members of the committee. For the record, Judy Stigler. And this bill was actually taken up by Representative Kotek at my request. It had been one I had drafted, and it came to me. Some of you may know that I... Yes, sir.
I'm going to get you to take a break here, just because I believe Council wants to actually give you the correct staff summary instead of the one that he gave. So we're
okay.
We're rewinding the tape, as I would say.
I gotcha.
It's Tuesday, kind of in the twilight today. And so now we're going to have the summary on House Bill 2272A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The sponsors are the same. It gives court-appointed special advocate Castle the power to consult with as well as inspect a copy of the records of child that are in possession of agency, hospital, school organization, doctor, nurse, psychologist, psychiatrist, police department, or mental health clinic. My apologies.
Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you saved me having to go back and correct for the record, so I appreciate that. I didn't want anybody to get confused as to what the actual bill did. As I indicated, some of you may know I'm in a former existence. I was a CASA director in Central Oregon for 9 years. And under the existing CASA statutes, CASAs have the right, once they're appointed, to a plethora of records regarding the child. And an issue came to my attention about a year and a half ago, that many school districts in particular and some doctors, hospitals, those kind of agencies had issues regarding not releasing the records, but actually having conversations or discussing the records with the CASA once the records have been released. So what this is a simple fix to make it very clear that once the records are released, that the entity, whether it's a school, a hospital, a physician, a psychologist, any of those, have the ability to actually consult with and have a conversation with the CASA representative regarding those records. And the engrossed version is different from the original version. The original had the word shall, and there were some concerns on the part of a variety of folks that would give CASAs the ability to subpoena a school teacher or somebody like that, that it would sort of enhance. It went beyond what was intended. The intent was to make it clear that there was no liability connected with actually consulting with and having a conversation regarding the records that were released. So we went back and changed the language to may consult. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Megan?
Thank you for having me, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Megan Schultz. I'm the Executive Director of CASA of Lane County, but I'm here today representing the Oregon CASA Network. There's 31 programs serving all 36 counties, children in all 36 counties throughout the state of Oregon. There's 1,800 CASA volunteers serving 4,300 children across the state, and we support this bill. We believe that it will clarify and strengthen the statute and allow CASAs to get their work done in a timely manner and be able to bring information that they need to bring to the court. So we appreciate your support of this bill.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Wissett first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just walk us through how a court-appointed special advocate is selected and screened and appointed?
How a court-appointed special advocate volunteer is selected
and screened and appointed?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a pretty extensive process. In my county alone, last quarter we had over 100 people apply to be a CASA volunteer, and we only screened in 27 for our 40 hours of training. So they have to fill out an application. They have to give 5 references in writing that are reviewed and checked. They do a criminal background. We do a criminal background check. In our program, they also go through a telephone interview and then a 2-hour face-to-face interview with 2 staff people. And then our 40 hours of training are also considered screening. So you can go get through all the way through training, and we would not accept you into the program if there were any red flags for us. So it's a pretty elite group of volunteers because we know that the stakes are really high.
Thank you for putting it on the record.
All right, Senator Cruz.
I think I'm okay, Mr. Chair. This seems circular for a minute. I had to read it about 3 times to get it right. And basically,
want to share?
Well, what I was looking at, because CASAs do have the rights to inspect and copy, but I guess what this is doing, it is specific to give CASAs the right to talk to people.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, and members of the committee, that's exactly right. When I was a director, I always assumed that if you had the ability to release the record, you could talk about it. But this, apparently there have been some issues, and this is just to make it very clear that you can also talk about it.
Okay. All right. Ladies, thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2272A? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2272A. And I'm going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing so we can get your testimony in.
Thank you.
I've got the next one is going to be House Bill 2714A.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2714A comes to you from Representative Tomei, creates the crime of patronizing a prostitute if a person pays or offers to pay a fee to another in order to engage in a sex act, classifies the crime as a Class A misdemeanor, sets the fine at $20,000 if the person to whom the fee was offered was under 18, does not require the state to prove the person knew that the person was under 18. If the court determines the defendant is unable to pay $20,000, allows the court to impose a fine that determines the defendant can pay, prohibits the court from waiving or suspending the fine. So, Chair, members of the committee, you have the A3 amendments in front of you, and if you look at the 2714A, on line 24, it says, for a person's first conviction, a fine of amount of $10,000. And then after that line, it would say, on 25, it would add at $20,000 a term of incarceration of at least 7 days. So for second conviction, it would be an amount of $20,000 plus 7 days in jail. After that, it would be $20,000 and 30 days in jail.
All right.
If I may, Mr. Chairman of the committee. Representative Tomei wanted me to point out to you that in the summary, it refers to the fine as being $6,250. That's the fine for an A misdemeanor. But if you go further on, it says mandatory minimum penalties under certain circumstances. And the summary is not the law. It's just the legislative council's way of giving a brief description of the bill.
That's correct. And this basically shows that it goes above and beyond what the maximum is for a Class A misdemeanor.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Carolyn Tomei. I represent House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. Today I have before you House Bill 2714A, which is one bill in a package of bills that deal with the sex trafficking of children. Sex trafficking of children is a very important issue to me, to my constituents, and to all the residents of our state. Oregon has gained the reputation as a hub for sex trafficking of children. Young girls and boys are routinely being sold on the streets of Portland. These children have often been previously victimized and need treatment and services.
These kids are not foreign nationals imported to the state. These kids come from our own cities, our suburbs, and our rural towns. Appropriate shelter and treatment is hard to find because often they don't recognize themselves as victims. They tend to run back to the streets when they are placed in foster homes. Law enforcement has a hard time getting them to testify against their pimps, and the buyers of sex just keep victimizing these kids over and over again with little consequences. House Bill 2714 deals with that demand side of prostitution. It greatly increases the penalties of those who buy sex from minors. Currently, the charge of prostitution applies equally to the buyers and sellers of sex. House Bill 2714 separates prostitution into two separate crimes. Prostitution refers to the crime of selling sex, and patronizing a prostitute applies to those who buy sex. It then imposes high fines on the buyers of sex with children, $10,000 for the first offense, $20,000 for the second, and for the third and subsequent offense, $20,000 plus. Bill, I had a questioner. I had 30 days, and I thought that's what I read in the bill, and it sounds like maybe you've amended that to 7 days.
No, it is 30 days for the third conviction. I have taken the opportunity to add 7 days on the second conviction.
Got it. I certainly support that amendment. Thank you. Moreover, the bill goes on to say, ignorance of age is no defense. It does not matter whether you knew the seller was underage. Sex with minors is wrong, and you will be prosecuted and subject to the high fine and some time in jail. We had much discussion with all of the stakeholders as we were dealing with this bill over the months about appropriate sanctions for those offenders who buy children. Is $20,000 too much? Should we post the pictures on the internet? How does public shaming affect the families of the offenders? In the end, we settled on the series of increasing sanctions. It makes the point loud and clear that children are off limits. Colleagues, sex trafficking of children is a very serious problem here in Oregon. It has serious and long-lasting effects on its victims. Washington has taken steps to combat it. California's laws are stricter than ours. House Bill 2714 is an important piece that Oregon needs to better protect your children, and I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Looks like we have two young ladies here.
Yes.
That want to give testimony. If you'd be so kind to give us your name before you give your testimony. And did you hand in written testimony? Okay, just checking. Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Przonski and members of the committee, I'm Brianna West, and this is Jillian Pope, and we're eighth graders at Leslie Middle School. In February, our social studies class did a project called Change the World. Change the World was a project where eighth graders research a problem in the world and do something about it. We chose our project to be human trafficking. As a community service portion of our project, we collected signatures from students and staff at our school and testified to the House Judiciary Committee on House Bill 2714. When we started this project, it was just something we were doing for a grade. But as we researched and found out perplexing facts and statistics, we began to form an emotional connection to this issue. The fact that young girls and boys our age were being sold for sex around the globe, and even here in Oregon, was appalling. We immediately wanted to do something more, something that would really make a difference. Now the Change the World project is over, but we're not stopping there. We are going to be there until the end. We are here with all 513 of our signatures to push the Senate to pass this bill, just as the House did. Today you're hearing testimony about House Bill 2714. You've already passed Senate Bill 425, which was sponsored by Chair Przonski. House Bill 2714 is your opportunity to continue the fight against human trafficking. We are here as representatives for over 500 students, asking you to pass this bill from committee and continue your support for young people trapped by circumstances that they can't control.
Thank you. We would be happy to answer any questions.
All right, ladies, thank you very much. Are there any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very
much. I wanted to ask the students a question.
You may.
When you testified in the House, did the House members ask you questions? Nope.
No, ma'am.
All right. Well,
you're very intimidating.
Yeah, normally we would ask questions, but you're very prepared, and we know that we would be stumped. So, with that, thank you very much for coming forward. Really appreciate you following this, not only in class, but actually taking your voices and carrying the voices for 500 other students here to the Capitol today. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we have a few other people who wanted to give testimony on this. And Diane McKinney, why don't you come on up, Commissioner? And let's see. I've got J.R., and I cannot pronounce the last name.
You did this first.
Better you said than me.
J.R. is fine.
All right, J.R. And then if I could also have Christine, is it Haydell? Christine
Haydell.
Okay. Commissioner, why don't you start us off, please?
Okay, thank you. I'm Diane McKeel, Multnomah County Commissioner. Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, I want to thank you for taking up this bill and the difficult issue that it attempts to address. I also want to thank Senator Bonamici and Senator Pozanski for their work around this issue as well. This bill is one of the first steps towards treating victims of sex trafficking as victims, not as criminals, and imposing real punishment on those who victimize them. This and some of the other bills that you will be facing this session will not solve the problem of sex trafficking in our state, but they are important steps toward a statewide effort that must take place. Only through cooperation and collaboration among federal government, state government, county, cities, and our citizens will we ever be able to fully resolve this issue. Thanks to the efforts of Representative Tomei, among many others, you have the chance to act statewide to help children who are victimized by this cruel practice. In Multnomah County, we are administering a federal grant from the Department of Justice designed to coordinate and organize all government, nonprofit, and stakeholder groups that are working to end the commercial sexual exploitation of children in the region. We have also created a diversion program for those arrested for attempting to buy sex. The Sex Buyer Accountability and Diversion Program educates Johns on the dangers of buying sex, the harm it causes to those they buy it from, and put to rest any ideas that they may have had that prostitution is a victimless crime. The mandatory $1,000 fee paid by each John that takes part will provide funding for law enforcement, treatment, and prosecution. In conjunction with the City of Portland and Janus Youth, we have worked to establish the first few shelter beds in Oregon for victims of this exploitation. Without question, the biggest gap in services that currently exist for victims of trafficking is lack of any shelter to safely house and treat victims. At the federal level, we continue to support Senator Wyden's legislation around creation of safe shelter and the needed services for the victims. Only through work by all forms of government will we ever end this terrible crime. If we continue to work to strengthen laws, to punish exploiters, and to aid victims, we will show the predators and abusers in this state that their business is no longer welcome here. Passing House Bill 2714 is a great step forward in this goal. Thanks to the great leaders at the federal, state, and local levels, we are making real progress, but there is much left to do. I thank you for hearing this bill, and I urge your support. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Whoever would like to go next, please.
Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, my name is Kirsten Heidel, and I'm the Youth Services Coordinator and Youth Advocate for Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, and I work directly with victims of human trafficking, domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 2714. Prostitution, as we know, exploits young girls, boys, women, and men. Entry age into prostitution is 12 to 14.
I ask you not to read your entire testimony. If you could summarize, that would be great.
Individuals involved in prostitution are often lured into prostitution. We know that individuals experience high levels of sexual violence, physical violence, and other forms of abuse. One victim that I had been working with had been lured into prostitution. Her pimp had presented as a boyfriend, and over time showered her with affection, with gifts, and then turned her out into prostitution. Another victim that we had worked with had been prostituted in three different states. She was 13 years of age, and she had been arrested by law enforcement as an adult. It's hard to believe that Johns would not see this victim as a youth. Johns often try to excuse their behavior, that they didn't know that this youth, their victims were youth. And we've heard of Johns parking outside of high schools, middle schools, elementary schools, trying to solicit sex from young girls and women. This bill is incredibly important because it sends a message to the victims that we do see them as victims and that they aren't criminals. These youth should be treated as victims of human trafficking, and they deserve to be recognized as victims that experience cruel, brutal, and incredibly extreme forms of abuse. Hopefully, as legislators, we will send a message to Oregonians and to the Johns and the Pimps that are exploiting these youth that Oregon will not tolerate the violation of basic human rights. Thank you.
Thank you. J.R.?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is J.R. Ujifusa. I'll spell my last name. It is spelled U-J-I-F-U-S-A. I am a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. For the last 3 years, I have been assigned to review all prostitution cases out of that county, as well as most of the pimp and human trafficking cases out of Multnomah County. And I am here today to support House Bill 2714. What this bill will do is decrease the demand on minors as well as adults around the ages of 18 to 20. Because as we know, through our experience and through my experience working with police officers and victims, there is no checking IDs or checking birth certificates to determine the age. So anyone who looks like a minor, this demand will decrease, as well as minors in general, for both street, internet, and any other type of prostitution that goes on in this state. In addition to that, prosecuting these individuals, this will take away a common defense that pimps and traffickers use in the Senate bill, as well as what Johns use as well, or buyers, which is, I didn't know she was underage. She said she was 18, 19, 20, 21. That is a common scheme for pimps and traffickers to manipulate their victims into stating their age as adults. This will no longer happen. In addition to that, this bill will hit Johns and pimps in one of the most important parts, their wallet. It will deter Johns away from even thinking about soliciting someone who is underage. In addition, when Johns have been questioned in studies in the past, one of the biggest deterrences they say is a large fine. In addition, it will hurt pimps and traffickers' businesses. As I know, in having many pimp cases as well as speaking with victims of prostitution and trafficking, money is almost all that matters to pimps and traffickers. Minors for pimps are a major target because they bring in the most amount of money. Victims I have spoken with, some as young as 10, have stated that they have performed up to 10 dates a day. This bill will decrease that number, will decrease the lure of minors for pimps and traffickers, and will send a strong and clear messages to Johns, and will give prosecutors the tools we need to prosecute these individuals. Thank you for your time, and I'm here for any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the Deputy DA, whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce. Thank you for your work. I'm glad you said something about the deterrent being there with the fine, because I've always struggled with understanding whether someone who's about to commit a crime really thinks, I think that a lot of them think they're not going to get caught. And so what's the deterrent value? So can you talk a little bit about how the word is going to get out, and is there sort of a network among these people who are out there on the streets so that is it going to be word of mouth? Are there going to be signs put up somewhere or stories in the paper so that people really know that this is really serious?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, I guess the best answer to your question is that there is an underground network of these individuals, and they speak regularly. And we monitor those blogs, those types of things. And yes, word will spread quickly. The study I'm referring to, and I wish I brought the actual study, I can't remember which state it took place in, the top three things that would deter Johns from doing it were public humiliation, their cars being towed, and their fine. And one of the reasons that's such a big deterrence is because many Johns or buyers that I come in contact with want to hide this from their significant other, their family members, and things such as a $10,000 fine is very hard and difficult to hide. So I believe this will spread very quickly throughout the community. And for those individuals who don't think before they act, I don't think there's anything we can do to deter them. But for most individuals, the money aspect is a huge deal to both the pimps and traffickers, which this will deter them from seeking out minors, because business will not be there, because the Johns will be deterred as well.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Wissa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, most criminal law in Oregon at least requires some form of culpability or intent. How are you going to get around that in prosecution?
This requires intent. Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt. This requires the intent because I have to prove intent on any crime. If it's not stated in the law, it's a knowledge. So they had to knowingly offer with the intent to sexual contact or conduct. So offer a fee with the intent for sexual conduct or contact under the law. So this would not change anything that I normally do in this case, which is under the regular prostitution statute, 167007. It just divides it into a buyer-seller type of law. So there is still intent required in every case I prosecute.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. All right, here's what the chair is going to do. I've got two other people that are scheduled to testify on this bill, Sybil Hebb and Christine Herman. I'm going to hold your testimony until tomorrow at this point. It looks like I've got 10 minutes. There's been a mistake that was made on the first set of bills we had. I want to get those individuals on the record if I can. And also, before you come up, Greg, I have a representative here, so Representative Brewer, I'm going to take your bill right now to get you in and out. So I'm going to recess at this point 2714A. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3433, and Counselor can give us a brief description.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill comes from Representative Brewer, allows a person 18 years or older who is under the Family Abuse Prevention Act protective order when under the age of 18 to seek a renewal of the order when the person fears and is over the age of 18.
All right. Representative.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Representative Katie Air Brewer, House District 29. And thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee, for allowing this hearing. As you know, it's gone through the House and passed over. Now it's here in the Senate. This is a protection order bill that will be narrowly applied, very small cases, a number of cases I anticipate, but it will help those who avail themselves of this. Right now, there's certain criteria in order to get a restraining order. One of them is that there is a qualifying event within 180 days prior to getting a restraining order. Often, a guardian will get a restraining order, and her children will also be protected in that restraining order. When the child contained in that or that's covered under that restraining order turns 18, they cannot get a new restraining order in their own right unless there has been a new qualifying event within the prior 180 days. But that doesn't mean the fear or risk has gone. So simply for having a birthday, a young child who's turned to the age of majority is at risk. What this bill does is allows them a tacking on of their restraining order that's been in place by their guardian that they can seek a renewal under their own right, independent of the parent guardian who has gotten the current restraining order. I learned this. My children had a restraining order under my protection from their father, and when they turned 18, they were not able to get coverage. When I asked the judge what other options do they have, there is none lawfully that they have for a restraining order. It's the only reason why I know of this little hole for children, and so I brought this forward to fill in the gap for those unique situations where a child simply for having a birthday is now at risk.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for the representative? Thank you very much. Sorry for the delay.
No, thank you.
Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 3433? Not seeing anyone. I'm closing the public hearing on 3433. I'm going to reconvene and reopen up our hearing, and I just got to get the data here.
reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2787A, House Bill 2792A, House Bill 2797A, and the informational meeting that was attached to it on the three concepts. Let's reopen. Greg, why don't you come forward? While Greg's coming forward, it has come to my attention that there are three people that were signed up that were not noted for the chair that have not been given an opportunity to testify. Greg Miller, who is here, will be testifying today. We will reach out to Stan Pate as well as Dan Lucas, who apparently were on the list, but on the list I received that I was working off was not included on that list, and we will do everything we can. We'll roll those over to give those individuals the opportunity to come back if they choose to. So, Greg?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Greg Miller. I represent the Oregon gun owners. Thank you very much for reopening these bills in the public hearing so I have a chance to put some points on the record. Be very brief. What I've handed out is some information that I've found on CHL laws around the state, some statistics on CHL holders and their correlation to crime rates, and simply what I found, you'll see on that document, is that crime, violent crime, does not correlate to CHL holders. You'll see specifically on the bottom of the page the Texas example, 2009, approximately 65,500 crimes committed, violent crimes. Of those, about 101 were by CHL holders. Of those 101 CHL holders, a very, very small percentage of those were actually related to the firearm, but more related to civil crimes, DWIs, issues like that. So I'd also like to point to a statistics. John Lott is a researcher who looked at the FBI's uniform crime data between 1977 and 1993. And found in his research that there are actually decreases in crime rates of murder, rape, and aggravated assault. And obviously when someone comes up with figures like that, they're going to be rebutted by other groups. But the end game or the end summary of all this was that scholars on both sides were able to agree that CHL licenses in states did not contribute to the increase of violent crimes. So in terms of reciprocity, allowing other folks to come into our state with a CHL from another state, it does not correlate to increased violent crime rates. Wisconsin and Illinois are two states in the union that don't offer a CHL. They allow open carry, but as far as allowing a concealed carry, they do not allow those. But I will say that this legislative session in Wisconsin, they're looking at adding a reciprocity or a CHL component to their statutes. So with that, I'll close. But thank you again for reopening the record to let me get my points.
And I apologize for the confusion. Is there a question for Greg? All right, thank you. So on the record, we had two other individuals that I stated that apparently had signed up, but based on the list that I was working off of, were not on it, Stan Pate as well as Dan Lucas. What I'm going to do is I'm going to carry over these public hearings, carrying them over till tomorrow. I'm hoping that staff will be able to make contact. I believe we have contact information from Mr. Lucas. Mr. Pate, I do not know, so hopefully if someone knows of him or whatever, may be able to get word to him. And we will accommodate them, if not tomorrow, on a date certain when they are available to come back, because they should have been able to give testimony today and would have been given that if we had kept up on the list and known that they had actually signed up for today. So with that, I'm carrying over House Bill 2787A, House Bill 2792A, and House Bill 2797A until tomorrow. That's next. And I'm also going to carry over House Bill 2714A. That purpose is carrying it over for two individuals who had signed up for testimony today that we were not able to accommodate, and that includes Christine Herman and Sybil Hebb. So the purpose for carrying over 2714A is to get their testimony since they were signed up today and we needed to make accommodations to get the other testimony. So that one is also being carried over. With that, I think that covers everything. There's nothing 34 or 33 we've taken care of. Councils, anything else you can think of? All right, tomorrow is Wednesday, and Pam, could you tell us what time we start? I think it's 30s. Thank you.
think you said Thursday 9.
I think Thursday's 9.
I can't remember what you did for tomorrow.
I think we're on 8:30. Yeah, well, we're just going to make sure. All right, I'm going to do executive decision here. I believe it should be 8:30.
It is.
All right, and so we will be here tomorrow, May 4th at 8:30, and I believe Thursday we have a later start time because of conflicts with other meetings. So with that, hopefully we'll see everyone back at 8:30, and we'll do our best to get Mr. Pate and Mr. Lucas in tomorrow if possible. If not, we'll make arrangements for their testimony in the future. With that, we're adjourned for the day.
You don't have a